Ladies and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of the largest and oldest wrestling family on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome your Studcast host of television and radio fame, Tony Basilio.
It is 93 years. It is four generations. My name is Tony Basilio, welcoming you to another edition of the Studcast. So excited to be with you for another week. And maybe it was Memphis, because that's where we're going today. We're going to go down Beale Street. We're going to visit with the King. We're going to take it into the old Ellis Auditorium. We're going to bring it all back to life. 10,000 plus people pulling themselves off the ceiling. I'm losing my voice. I'm so excited about it. It's allergy season here in the fall in East Tennessee. Please forgive me. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together, meet and greet the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. And Stud, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Tony. My pleasure to be here. This one I've been waiting for a while. I mean, I love Memphis. I love to talk Memphis. I love to be in Memphis. It's just one of my favorite wrestling cities of all time. And one of the historic stories of professional wrestling of all time is Memphis, Tennessee. And I just look forward to it. I say, man, roll her out whenever you're ready. I got my horse saddled up. And I'm ready to ride.
I tell you, I slowed that roll last week, and I got ripped. I got ripped over on the Facebook page, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. They told me, they said, less of you, more of Ron. Don't you ever call a show ever again, Basilio. So without further ado, Stud, I'm going to turn it over to you. Take me back to Memphis. Here we go.
All right. Well, we're going to go to 1959 again. This is going to set the stage. We're leaving Mobile, Locksley, Alabama, a little town where we built the farm and Dad's built his first wrestling company, Gulf Coast Wrestling. He sold it to the Fields brothers, and we're off to Memphis. I know nothing about Memphis. I'm in the fifth grade. I do remember that. I remember, and I think we spoke briefly about it last week, going to one of the first matches that Dad ran in Memphis and seeing maybe 300 people in a 10,000-seat arena. It was a sad occasion for me. And I had been accustomed to going to a few matches in the Gulf Coast area, and it was phenomenal. As many sometimes as 40,000 people in Ladd Stadium. Big, huge, monster events. And so we're 1959. We're in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis's background is there's a promoter there named Les Wolf, who was there prior to my dad coming in, who is a personal friend of my dad. He's a big part of my life, it turns out. As I grow up, he spends a lot of time around us. He's like my father. He's very interested in horses. He's interested in farms. He's interested in some of the same things my dad is, and they become very close friends, and that relationship holds for many, many years between the two of them. So Les Wolf is there and been there. He doesn't have the talent. I don't think he's working with Roy. Roy, being in Nashville, I think that he's not got Roy's talent because Roy is still doing well. His territory is on fire, and somehow he has lost control of Memphis, and it ends up in the hands of Les Wolf, who's a guy from Texas. And so Les is there and a part of all this. I go to the first match I see, and it's a small crowd. I told you last week, Dad goes out, and he tells his ringsiders that I don't want you coming back. Your permanent ringside seats that you've been sitting in for years are gone. I don't want you to come to any more wrestling matches here ever. He sends half of his 300 crowd home early and tells them never to come back. So Dad is, like we talked about a few episodes back, Dad and Roy are like carrying a torch for wrestling. They are lighting up the fans and the fan base wherever they go. And when we go to Memphis, I don't think my dad has any idea of where this is going, but he knows he's going to be successful because he was the type of guy that he didn't fail at what he did. He was always good at what he did. So he takes off and lights this torch in Memphis. And what we get there is the building. Let's talk about Ellis Auditorium. Ellis Auditorium is a 10,000 seat arena. It has two sides to it and a big concrete wall. We talked about this briefly last week, that they pull up. When one side sells out, they start selling tickets in the other side. For very few events, they ever drew that kind of a crowd. But it got to where, toward the end in the time frame there, it was every week. They knew they were going to use both sides of the arena. They could be having wrestling in that building and having a play on the other side, and you couldn't hear anything. You wouldn't know what's going on. So they booked both sides on many, many nights. But when it was wrestling night, after Dad had been there 6-8 months, it started to turn around. And that building, they would hold both sides for wrestling because they knew that they were going to fill out that entire building, one of the few times that that happened. So when he went there, he made certain changes. I like to call this the keys to building the territory. And there are certain things that has to happen in order for a territory to catch fire and to take off. And I thought about this some. There's about 6 different things that have to happen when you start a wrestling company if you're going to be successful. One of them, and maybe the most important, is your talent. Do you have the right wrestlers? Do you have guys that are committed, guys that want to go out there and build? It's easy when you're a wrestler to go out and work in a building that's full because the fans invigorate you. They get involved in the match and it permeates right into your body. I get those goosebumps we talk about sometimes from those big crowds and those big pops that you get from a big crowd. But when you go into a building where there's nobody there, it's how much effort you're going to give in those situations that make the difference in building a territory. I experienced it when I got my second business started and I went back and bought Gulf Coast Wrestling from Lee Fields. And we went in there and it was dead. That territory was fairly dead. And you had to go out there and all of your wrestlers had to be committed to working just as hard for 300 people as you work for 10,000. And that's hard to ask of your wrestlers because it's difficult for your wrestlers to get excited about a small payoff and a small crowd out there. They'll wrestle a lot harder for a big crowd than they will a little crowd. And that's where you decide who you want. Talent is number one. You have to have those guys committed. So since we're on talent, let's just roll into his talent. I'm going to call this his crew because Dad not only built Memphis, he built Arizona. He built Atlanta. He put Florida back on the map when they were struggling. He has, everywhere he went, he took that torch and he lit those fans up. And when they left, he never left one that wasn't selling out. So now he's happy. He's left. He's accomplished everything in Mobile. He's had those huge crowds. He's accomplished what he wanted to. Now he's starting all over again where it's dead. And he's going to build build one of the monster cities of all time in wrestling, and that's going to be Memphis. So he's got this crew that he brings in. The first one is probably one of Memphis' all-time heroes, and he was a heel. And his name was Sputnik Monroe. Sputnik was a 6-foot, 225-pound guy, had black hair and a bleach blonde streak through the middle of it like a skunk. It looked a little bit like a skunk. It reminded you of a skunk. But boy, he did not stink in the ring. He had great, great charisma. He was a heel that everyone, not everyone loved, but the black population in Memphis, which is a big part of Memphis's population, the black part of the population in Memphis enthralled by Sputnik Monroe. Sputnik spent his time every night walking the streets of Beale. And if you've ever been to Beale Street in Memphis, that's a pretty nice little stroll right down that street. That's a nice little stroll. You're going to get a feel for what Memphis is all about in about four blocks. And you're going to hear some of the best music on the face of the earth. You're going to see some of the most happy people in America. It's a phenomenal city, that Memphis. And he strolled down Beale Street. He was the champion. He wore his belt outside his clothes. He went in every establishment. He shook every person's hand. And the black community just, they went to him in droves. He had a signature thing he used to do. The Rock got up on the turnbuckle and gave you the old lie for Vince. Sputnik's deal was he would go into the ring, and the Ellis Auditorium back in those days, it was segregated, not integrated like today. This is in 1960, and the top balcony was for blacks, and they couldn't sit anywhere else in the crowd. Terrible. You know, when we think about it this day, it's just ridiculous to even think about how things were. But that happened to be the times. And the black crowd on the top of the top balcony up there, would Sputnik would go in the ring and he would turn sideways and he would look up into the top balcony. He didn't care about the rest of the crowd. He didn't want the rest of the crowd. He would point to his people in the top balcony. He would turn his face sideways and he would take his finger and start it at his head and he would come straight down his face with it like the profile, Daddy. And I'm telling you, that balcony up there, the rest of the building would be going booing like crazy. And that balcony, they would literally, I have seen them hang from that balcony. It's a 200-foot drop, I'm sure, from the top of that balcony. They would be hanging from that balcony. They loved Sputnik Monroe. He was over.
Let me ask you something about that while you're talking about his relationship with the African-American community down there in Memphis. He would go and drink in their bars, and he would get arrested on trumped-up charges. These were days where blacks and whites, it was frowned upon that you're seen with blacks in public. He would literally go, the accounts are, that he would go into black bars and drink. Now, was that by design part of the character that he was playing, or was he truly a guy that had a heart for that community, and he said, hey, let's incorporate this?
I think it was both. He had, Sputnik, he had a fabulous personality. He was a character personified. He was a personal friend. I was around him a lot when I was a kid, and he would always mess with me. When he went to Beale Street, he would go down that street, and he would have his arms around two African Americans. He didn't care. He drank in the black places. It was his element. I think it was his element, but I think Dad must have told him, you know, what you're doing is really getting over. You're really becoming a star here. And what was happening is he was starting to build things with Sputnik by himself. He had another guy. His top baby face was a guy named Billy Wicks. Now, a lot of people won't know Billy Wicks. Billy Wicks became the police chief in Memphis. He retired after wrestling. He was so admired and respected, he became a police officer and worked his way to being one of the biggest police officers in the city. And he was obviously white. He was very handsome. He was built very well, had a tremendous wrestling ability. Came out of Minnesota, the Minnesota area, and was a tremendous wrestler. And eventually, those two guys are going to set an all-time record in the Memphis attendance. Memphis has been a phenomenal wrestling city since Dad came there. But the biggest crowd ever drawn to any wrestling event in Memphis was drawn by Billy Wicks and Spudnik Monroe. And we'll get to that later on. He had Don and Al Green, old-timers. There were young guys out of Tennessee at that point that were really go-getters, could really wrestle good. He had Greg Peterson, came out of that same area as Billy Wicks, personal friends, great wrestler. Lester came with him. Herb was one of his stars. Herb was still wrestling. 25 years into his career, was still a star, big star there. You had the Fargos, both of them, Don and Jackie Fargo, big stars there. The Von Brauners with Saul Weingraf, one of the greatest teams. Two German guys, 250, 260, back when guys weren't that size. Phenomenal team, drew a tremendous amount of money. And Mario Galento, who we have talked about on many occasions from the Gulf Coast experience where Dad started. So that's basically his group of talent. He's got one thing in his favor right off the bat. He has a great crew, and they are all committed to building his territory, just like they helped him build his territory along the Gulf Coast. So the second thing you really need is you need a booker. You got to have a mind. You got talent. But if you don't have a direction that you want to go with your people, then you're not going to get to where you need to be. He always had good people. Most of the time he did it himself. Your booker leads your company to be successful or to fail. And he's that important to you. And he relied upon himself. I think that's why he didn't wrestle to begin with in a lot of these cities that he went to build. And he started wrestling later because he would take that book once it's rocking and give it to somebody else. Then he would go in the ring and start to produce on that end. He had the booker. He had the talent. He had television. Now, he didn't just have television. They were on, I think it's WHBQ, if I remember, is the call letters in Memphis, Tennessee. It was on Channel 13, something like that. And I'm really recalling from way, way back. Could be totally wrong about that. But he goes to the HBQ, and he convinces them. I don't even remember what time the program was on. He says, let's do something with wrestling that's never been done. Let's boost this program from an hour to 90 minutes, and let's go live. And they said, no, I don't know about the live, you know, we won't be able to, you know, we want to control it. He says, no, let's do it live. So somehow he talks the management into WHBQ into going live from 10:30 to 12 noon on Saturday mornings. It becomes, over a period of 2 years, probably the most watched television wrestling program in the world. It just blows the market, blows up with it. Now you've got the talent, you've got the booking, now you've got a 90-minute show, which gives you a lot of time to expose great wrestlers, lots of times for interviews. It gets you your product out there better than any other way that you could possibly do it. Then he goes and he makes another wonderful decision on this part. He hires maybe the best television commentator, one of the best that ever lived, in Lance Russell. He brings Lance Russell in as his commentator. Lance is young and energetic and gung-ho and sees the potential, and not just sees the potential, he seizes the opportunity to make a name for himself because he sees that this show is going to be huge. And Lance becomes the man in Memphis. That show rides on his back, and he does such a phenomenal job with it. It's really amazing what he does. And then the last element of what I say is in the building blocks of a territory is the marketing. My dad was phenomenal at it, and I watched it in Mobile as a young kid. Didn't realize how what he was doing, but in Memphis, I was older, and I got a feel for what he was all about. He left no stone unturned when it came to wrestling's name. He had a moniker he used in the Gulf Coast called Wrestling King of Sports. And when we went to Memphis, he took that moniker with him. Do you know that New Japan Pro Wrestling is still using that Wrestling King of Sports? He took that King of Sports and he put it on every taxi cab. He put it on every bench. He put it on the backs of buses. He put it on billboards. He put it on radio stations. He put it everywhere. You didn't go anywhere in Memphis and not say, by gosh, wrestling is the king of sports. And people believed it. They saw it there on everything. They got to believe in it. And all of a sudden, this town in which there were 300 people, and he sent half of them home, is now filling both sides of Ellis Auditorium. And if you live in Memphis, Tennessee, you don't know that wrestling is big, then you're living under a rock somewhere. Because it is the biggest thing that ever came to Memphis. And wrestlers talk about it to this day. They're blown away by the atmosphere when you wrestle in Memphis.
You know, you were talking, and I'm looking up some things on Wicks Monroe, how they set the territory up and what your father did. And just looking at that time period, just for perspective, okay? When Wicks and Monroe wrestle in the late 50s, early 60s, they're drawing crowds of 10,000. Elvis Presley drew a house before he was drafted of 6,300. Now, I want people to stop and think about that, what I just told you, for a second. The king himself was playing to about 75% capacity. Wrestling, it is so over in that town that they're getting capacity crowds. Records that were set for wrestling in that town until we got into the days when they moved to the big barn uptown. But for the most part, we're talking about numbers on television that'll never be touched. And the penetration of the sport back then, just on top of the mind, the Q rating, as we use in our profession these days, Ron, the Q rating of a Sputnik Monroe there must have been off the charts.
Obviously. I mean, they're doing unheard of things. And everybody else around the country and around the world, they're all popping. They're all doing these big numbers. But Memphis, you got to think in 1960, I have no idea what the population of Memphis was in 1960 as compared to today. But you're drawing 10,000 people in probably a city that's maybe only 250,000 population. You're getting a pretty big, significant number of people that live there are coming to your event. I never knew those figures. That's an amazing figure there, Tony. I mean, when Elvis can't sell out and wrestling can, and it's Elvis's hometown, then that in itself tells you exactly how big wrestling, how big Dad had made wrestling.
Yeah, and I'll send you a great link. It's from Scotty Moore's website where he talks about the Ellis Auditorium that I found listening you talk about right in that first segment. I emailed it to you. Perhaps we can get it up for this episode for folks to look at. Some great shots of the Ellis Auditorium and how the place laid out. But it talks about those numbers there. And then I'm looking at another piece from that time frame, which talks about the types of crowds that wrestling drew. And the city went from a population of 300,000 in 1950, and then after the baby boom and everything else, in the early 60s, stud, actually 600,000 became the population one time of Memphis. But even there, in a crowd of 600,000, to consistently draw 10,000 folks and sell out a building, and to do it in a spot where eventually Monroe, and I'm sure you're going to get to this as part of the story, but he becomes so over with the black population in that town that he says, I want them to be able to sit anywhere. And so eventually we have an integration that happens through professional wrestling in Memphis, which is something, Stud, you got to be really proud of, man, that took part under your dad's banner.
That's right. I am proud of it. I mean, I think they should have been sitting down in the ringside back in those days. I was never prejudiced, nor was my dad, nor was Roy. You know, we felt like everybody was made equal and everybody should be treated the same. It was amazing what happened. And another thing, Tony, that people don't really realize probably is when you sell out an arena, how many people do you think wanted to get in there that couldn't? That's a significant number. And I know that for a fact. I remember wrestling in Knoxville when things were really big and wrestling Harley Race and having 9,000 people in a building made for 2,000 people sitting on those aisleways up and down in the balcony so that people couldn't walk to get drinks and things. And there was a patio outside there that I had guys tell me that, Ron, there's more people on the patio than what we can put in the building that can't get in to see it. So we could have drawn 15, maybe 20,000 people, and there was just no building big enough to hold those numbers. So if Ellis had 10,000 in it, how many do you think would have been there if it had been 20,000 seats?
What I love about that story, though, is, and we're seeing this in modern college football, which is where I make my living in college sports, they're shrinking those buildings. Because what they're realizing is if I've got a shrunken building, I create more demand. The demand for those tickets back then must have just been off the charts. When you told your friends, hey, I'm going to watch Wicks and Monroe or some of the other people that you mentioned, some of those Hall of Fame names that you were talking about, generational names. Can you imagine in parts of Memphis or over there in West Memphis, over there in Arkansas, somebody flashing four tickets? Now, let me ask you this. How would tickets have been sold back then? What venues would they have used to sell a ticket? Because we know today we got the modern internet. What would you have used back then?
You know, oddly enough, here's what I really remember and I recall about it is there was no advance sale. You could not go and buy tickets in advance. So when you had an wrestling event, I remember my mom sold tickets. She sold tickets when we were at the Gulf Coast. She went on nights and we had babysitters, me and Robert. And even in Memphis, she went down to the arena because you had to be prepared for a 10,000 walk-up. You did not sell in advance. You had a window. If you were getting ringside tickets, you had a reserved window that was for fans who sat in the same seat every week. And probably, you know, it's like a season ticket holder for a football game or for whatever the event may be. And that's the way things were back in his day. You had your ringsiders that came every week. I want that seat. And I get it every week. They would come every week. That ticket would be there for them, and they'd pass through the turnstiles pretty quickly. Now, if you wanted to buy a ticket in ringside, and there were some available, you had to stand in a line to do that. Everybody else stood in lines. So when you had an event like that, you might have 25 ticket windows, and all of those windows with ticket sellers in it. You had to be prepared to sell every one of those tickets or probably 90% of those tickets at the door. And that was a pretty nasty thing. I have seen that in hockey. My first experience with hockey, when I got my hockey team in Nashville and they said, you're going to fail, we weren't prepared. We had a huge walk-up. I had the hockey guy say, Ron, you're not going to walk up anybody. If they don't buy a ticket in advance, you won't walk up anybody hardly. And our first night in Nashville with the Nashville Knights, we had to hold up the game for 45 minutes because they had a 3,000 or 4,000 people walk up. They weren't expecting it. So it was the way businesses were back in those days. It was before you could buy your tickets in advance, and everybody had to be geared up to sell your tickets that night. I was always that way when I first started in my first Southeastern Wrestling Company in Knoxville. I had to have several or many in the Coliseum events. I had to hired my ticket sellers. And they handled the box offices and stuff because they were prepared for it. They could do it.
All cash?
All cash. Nobody had a credit card. What do you think? You think back, you know, 1960, who had a credit card? Then people didn't even know what the hell credit cards were. They had yet to figure out how to do a credit card. So, you know, you walked up and you paid your money and you were lucky to get in. And a lot of times it was a horrible deal to be standing in that line, I'm sure, and you're 10 people away and they put that sold out sign up there. They closed those windows. It was a nasty little deal. I hated that when I was running business, and I watched them close those deals, sold out. I loved it, but I hated it too, because you had hundreds and maybe thousands that were willing to buy and wanted to buy and wanted to be in there. Your building just wasn't big enough to hold them all.
Think about what they do now in these venues. They scalp tickets to the very people that want to get in and go. It's a completely different world. In the cash days, Ron, answer me this. How much of that gets claimed and how much doesn't from these promoters around the country? I mean, it's a great question, right?
Hell yeah, it's a great question. I don't know if I really answered that question honestly. You know what I mean? When you own a company and all your business is cash, you know, it's pretty hard to not have a propensity to say, well, maybe it wasn't quite as good as it was. You know, that's why the boys were always funny. The guys in the business that were paid, they were always paid a percentage of the gate. Mm-hmm. And some guys just would try to convince you, especially when you were the owner, they would say, you know, I know exactly what the house is. And I would say, wait a minute. And what do you mean you know exactly what the house is? And they would say, I'm going to tell you how many people's in this building. You know, I would say, okay. Well, go ahead, tell me, because I look around, I say, I can't tell you. How can you tell me? Oh, I know. And then I would ask them, a lot of them, they would complain sometimes. They would go, I don't know about that. I'm sure we had 8,000 people or whatever it was. And I would say, no, there was 6,000, which it really probably was 6,000. No, but there was always somebody in the dressing room that would walk out there and tell everybody else, I can tell you what's in that house. You know, so it was a contentious matter every once in a while. I never dealt with it too much because I wanted guys to work for me that were happy with what they were paid. And I had kind of a reputation after a while that if you complained about that, then you might not be there very long, because I didn't cheat anybody, and I treated my guys good and I paid very well. And we always had great crews and great success because of it. It could be a contentious matter, you know, and I know that they probably didn't record all. You know, it's kind of like the same thing, though, with other sports, hockey games, for instance. Have you ever heard that announced crowd and really look at the crowd? You know, when you start dissecting figures like that, and they say you're in a 15,000 seat arena, you know, you got 5,000 seats that ain't filled, and they say we've got 13,500 people here tonight. You gotta go to yourself, wait a minute now, they're not here. So are they counting people that bought tickets that didn't come, or where are they getting those extra numbers from? When you were in hockey, you could do that. You never announced a crowd in wrestling. Have you ever heard them announce a crowd in wrestling?
No.
I don't think I've ever heard them.
No.
It was never done, so you didn't worry about that. But in hockey, they wanted to know, sports writers and stuff, they wanted, how many you got here tonight? You know, and it was up to you to give them the figure, you know? So it's different in every sport, I assume. But wrestling, you never had to announce what you had. They knew what you had in Ellis. You had 10,000, by golly, because there was no seats left.
In modern day, you know, McMahon will do the gimmicked attendance figures for WrestleMania, an event like that, and it's always gimmicked. And you know it's gimmicked because he's a publicly traded company now, and they have to put the real figure down. It comes out 6-8 weeks later that, you know, he plussed it up 18, 20, 25,000. That's fact. So why give the gimmick attendance out if the real one's going to come out eventually? But he's probably banking on most people not being smart enough to go down the line and look what the actual attendance was. Because a lot of times they'll plus that thing up 20-25%.
Yeah, they will. I'm sure they will. And that's just about in every sport. I don't think that's just with wrestling either. And in his case, I think there's a lot of sports that bump those numbers. You want your organization and your team or whatever it is, you want it to be successful. And if you can bump those numbers and make yourself look more successful, that's probably something that's been done since teams and those type of opportunities became available. I'm sure everybody taking advantage of that.
We come back on the Studcast. We're going to get to your questions and your comments, and we've got some great ones today. And if you want to ask a question of the Stud, I want to encourage you to check out the Facebook page, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. Again, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. And the website is tnstud.com. Again, tnstud.com. Some great merchandise available there. Some great links as well. Some of the things that we discuss. And we'll come back on the other side. Get to your questions as we unpack Memphis. Boy, the journey is just beginning here as we come back on the other side on the Studcast after this.
The Studcast continues in 1 minute. You're listening to Studcast number 11, featuring stud stories as told by the legendary Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, and hosted by Tony Basilio. This Studcast will continue in a moment. Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, is constantly making changes to his website, tnstud.com. It's tnstud.com. If you go to tnstud.com and click on gallery, you'll notice the addition of many new photos. As always, there's a reason for what he does for all of his fans. And now let's go to the Tennessee Stud himself for this website update.
Thanks, Dave. I appreciate this opportunity to thank everyone for the tremendous success we've been having with both the Stubcast and the website. I've been telling these stories about my family members for 10 weeks now, and I realize that every great story deserves a visual accompaniment to make the listener's enjoyment even better. Sometimes a picture is truly worth a thousand words, and I think that's what it is in this case with my Studcast. That's what we have done for our Studcast listeners. Please take a look at the new gallery at Tennessee Stud, that's tnstud.com, and you will now see my grandfather, Roy Welch, his brothers, Herb and Lester, his bear, Ginger, my father, Buddy Fuller, the Fields brothers, Bobby, Don, and Lee, and my brother, Robert, and I, when we were kids. All photos will have names and dates below them so that you'll recognize who the individuals are, and you also see the time frame that we were talking about in that particular Studcast. We will update the gallery regularly to match the characters introduced and with each Studcast. And then when you go to Tennessee Stud, that's tnstud.com, before or after each Studcast, it should make every ride with me a lot better. And I want to thank everyone, and I hope you really enjoy the changes that we've made to the website. And we'll take a good look at it. Thank you.
Thanks, Stud. And if fans have suggestions about improving the website or Studcast, please like us on Facebook at Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud. And then leave us a message. We'd like to thank the thousands and thousands of fans for their phenomenal support. And don't forget to saddle up and ride with the Stud every Studcast. And please tell your friends about us. Find the Stud on Facebook at Ron Fuller Tennessee Stud and on the World Wide Web at tnstud.com. For exclusive offers from the Tennessee Stud, visit his website at RonFullerTennesseeStud.com. You are back, seated ringside, on this edition of the Ron Fuller Studcast.
Tennessee Stud, it's hard to believe, man. We are almost through another episode here. It's incredible how much have packed into 35 minutes so far here on Studcast 11. Are you ready to take some questions, my man?
Yes, I am. I love these questions.
All right.
What do you got?
Corsica came up in our last Studcast. Today, we've got a question from Micronesia. Kalanya Papanepei, Micronesia. I'll show how illiterate I am. I'm probably so far off the pronunciation of that place. But this is Frank Burkett, who's listening to us in Micronesia. And he says, Ron, as a team, what program was your father involved in that upset you and worried you the most? As a teen, I think is what he's trying to get at. What is a program your dad, when he was wrestling, that's a great question, upset you or worried you the most?
It is a great question, you know, because my dad never hinted to me what was going on. He taught me to shoot. I had such respect for what guys did that it was truly amazing how I was brought up. And when I think back upon it, Robert, too. So I remember Mario Galento. Mario Galento is a name that I think about when I think about some of my dad's toughest matches that he ever had. The one that comes to my mind first off is in Mobile in 1958 with 40,000 people in Ladd Stadium with Joe Louis as a referee and dad against Galento. Lasted 5 minutes. They beat each other up so bad. Hard weighed each other, broke each other's noses. The dad, for 2 weeks, his eyes were shut and he couldn't even see to drive. Then I'm going to go now to a second time that they wrestled. That was 59. In 1966, they wrestle again in Atlanta, Georgia, in one of the biggest, I think it may be probably the biggest crowd ever drawn in Atlanta for wrestling. Mario against my dad again. And the referee that night is the undefeated world boxing champion, maybe the greatest boxer of all time, Rocky Marciano. That event was just as big as the one in Mobile. And Mario was a tremendous athlete in very good shape. And 2 weeks prior to that match, my dad wrestled on a Saturday night in Marietta, Georgia. During that match in Marietta, they had a riot. And the fans came to the ring. My dad was fighting to help the heels get back to the dressing room. And he was stabbed. He was cut by someone with a knife from behind on the right side. Two rows, 55 stitches inside and out to close his wounds. This might have been a month ahead of the match with Mario, but he's going to wrestle Mario. And when he gets cut like that and he comes home that night, I hear Mom crying and I don't know what's going on. And the next day I see him at breakfast and he's kind of leaning and he's selling his right side. And I say, "You hurt?" And yeah, a little bit, you know, he didn't want to talk about it much. He was cut pretty badly. So he's wrestling that Friday night. I don't remember who he's wrestling. I keep telling him during the week, I say, "You're not going to wrestle with those stitches in your side, are you?" And he, "Yeah, yeah." You know, and I'm like, "You can't. How the heck are you going to do that with stitches in your side?" So he wrestles a different opponent that night. And I remember during standing on the stage in the old auditorium in Atlanta. And during that match, Mario left the dressing room and went to the ring, hit him in the side where his ribs was. He had his side taped. He had no top on, but he had his side taped. And Mario pounded him and stomped him in the side and ripped the bandage off enough that it bled because he still hadn't had his stitches removed. And I was probably 16 years old, 17. I was a junior in high school, so whatever that age is. And it affected me. I was like, wow. I mean, that's what a dirty, no good son of a gun. I mean, and 4 weeks later, they drew the biggest crowd in the history of Atlanta wrestling. And Atlanta's had some big crowds, Omni's and all those big buildings, but none of them could hold what the old Ponce de Leon baseball stadium held, which was on Ponce de Leon Avenue across the street from Sears and Roebuck's national headquarters. I don't know what the capacity of the arena was, but the crowd was so large that I sold tickets that night. I was a junior in high school, maybe a senior, and I sold tickets that night, and it was amazing how many people were left outside that park that couldn't get in. They had blocked off a six-lane street, Ponce de Leon Avenue. They had closed it down because they could not get the cars, and the buses would stop, and people were standing in the street backed up from the ticket windows. It was an awesome sight as a kid looking at how many people they were begging to buy tickets, hanging from the ticket booth that I was working in off of the rails, their bodies, and pushed in with their faces pushed against bars to keep them from getting their hands in, and just begging for a ticket. "Please, gosh, get me in, get me in." A monster, monster crowd. No telling how many it would have been. That was probably the program that really bothered me the most. It produced ultimately the largest crowd to ever see a wrestling event in Atlanta.
That Ponce de Leon had a capacity for baseball, I'm looking here online, of 6,800 people. Now, you can imagine how many more people you could get, thousands and thousands and thousands of more folks on the field itself if you surrounded it with a ring. And interestingly enough, the Atlanta Black Crackers used to play in that ballpark. And another side note about that Ponce de Leon stadium, the Georgia Tech Yellow Jackets played there one time, and there was a fight. You had mentioned Cowboy Luttrell in a previous episode when you were talking about Florida. In 1940, 45-year-old Jack Dempsey fought Cowboy Luttrell down there in that stadium, I guess when Dempsey was looking to pick up some money, one of those boxing versus wrestling deals. But it's interesting when you start looking at the history of those old venues, some of the great things you can unearth like that. That's a great question.
That's amazing. I never knew that. And I'll tell you what, I do remember that night that there were 5,000 seats on ringside. They were put out there on the field because they knew they were going to sell out. And I remember that they opened up the entire field. So there had to be, when I went in, left the ticket and went actually and stood and looked at the crowd, there was people backed up from the back of ringside into all three fields in the outfield, almost to the wall. And no way they could have seen the ring. It was called standing room, and it has kept selling standing room. Obviously, the 5,000 ringside seats were sold, and then they started with the standing room process. It was in the 30s. I'm sure the crowd was in the 30,000s or above. It was a monster crowd. Great question, though.
Great question. Let's get to our next question here. This is Stanley Nix of Crossville, Alabama, who asked the following. Who was your toughest opponent and why?
Another good question. Boy, and I've had a bunch of them. Yeah. I'm going to tell you off the top of my head, this name you will know, I'm sure, and wrestling fans, a lot of them around the country will know. I thought one of the toughest guys I ever wrestled in my life was Johnny Valentine. Johnny Valentine was 6'5", 250 pounds, blonde hair, fabulous body, and a wrestling machine and a pulverizer. He had the blow he called the hammer, and his son, Greg, was a great wrestler, tried to do the hammer, but there was no one that could hammer you like Johnny Valentine. And Johnny Valentine, when I was young, my second, third year, I was married to Johnny Valentine in Florida for probably 6 months. I wrestled him 3-4 times a week. And I think a lot of that was because nobody else wanted to wrestle him. Guys went and complained and said, he beats me up too bad. And I was young and didn't care. I just wanted to learn. And his style was totally different than any wrestler I ever wrestled in my whole career. He had a way of, he would take a front face lock as an example and take you down on the mat. He would hold you in that hole for 30 minutes. You would get out of it 3 or 4 times and he'd get it right back. And he never wanted to have a match that was less than 45 minutes. And to go 45 minutes with a guy who beats and pulverizes you the way he would do is really, really difficult. He really respected me for some reason. He liked me a lot. He taught me a lot. He made me a better worker than I would have ever been had I not had matches with him. And I never looked forward to wrestling him, but I always appreciated the opportunity because you always learn something when you wrestle him. He is one of those guys that quite opposite of what they do now, where they flip-flop and fly, and there's no rhyme nor reason nor philosophy to what's happening. You got exactly the opposite of that with Johnny Valentine. You got nothing but solid wrestling. And when you started to come out of it after one of those 30 minutes down on your face again and again and again, and you started those comebacks, you got more reaction from the crowds than was ever imagined prior to that. It was phenomenal wrestling Johnny Valentine because you got pops. Because by the time you're 45 minutes into it and you're finally getting the upper hand, it friggin' changes all of everybody's in that building. They're 100% now. They're just on the edge of their seat. Is this kid going to be able to do it? I love those matches. It was a phenomenal experience for me. Johnny Valentine, undoubtedly.
Talk about a master's class in wrestling, going around the horn with that guy. What a blessing that is for a young kid, huh?
Oh, it was phenomenal. I mean, I was in a great place. Florida was a great, you got the Nick Bockwinkles and the Ray Stevens and the Johnny Valentine and the Ole and Gene Andersons. And I mean, it was just Bobby Shane. It was just, and I was young and I was good. And I was getting that chop shot. I was getting those main events. I was wrestling those guys that were phenomenal. And it was sending me places. I was going to St. Louis in 74 when nobody my age was wrestling there. I was becoming a star, a bona fide star, because of all that I went through in those Florida years.
Bet you could tell me where you were that day in October of 1975 when Valentine was involved in that plane crash with Ric Flair, David Crockett, Brugers, and others. I think Tim Woods was also in that crash, and it ended up paralyzing Valentine, which was very, very, very tragic, obviously. Where were you when you found out about that?
I was living in Knoxville, and I remember talking to Flair, asking him about that wreck, you know, because I had experienced one earlier in Florida in which Bobby Shane died with Buddy Colt. Buddy Colt and Austin Idol and Gary Hart and Bobby Shane were on a small plane flying from Miami back into Tampa, and they crashed in Tampa Bay, and Bobby drowned. So those plane crashes, and I had been on so many private planes, and we're going to get to those stories too. Horrible, horrifying experiences. And I had, the worst part about that plane crash is they could see the airport. They ran out of gas and they were making the approach and they couldn't get over this last fence. The fuel was gone. They were gliding and all four of them seeing that we're going to make it. We're not going to make it. We're going to make it. We're not going to make it. And they didn't make it. Horrible experience. We lost one of the greatest workers of all time in that plane wreck right there, just like with Bobby Shane, one of the greatest workers of all time. Both of those guys, Johnny Valentine and Bobby Shane, great workers.
Really interesting question from Stanley Nix of Crossville, Alabama, who kicked us into a really interesting conversation. And you can see in the Studcast here, there are so many things. We talk about those harrowing plane episodes and incidents and travel incidents, and I bet we could do several shows on that alone. Let's get to question number three. Sean Estep of Knoxville, Tennessee, asked the following. Did you ever wrestle Don Carson in a coal miner glove match?
That has to be somebody from Knoxville. That sounds right to me. Don Carson was wrestling in Knoxville with me in 1975 and on into 1976. He managed the Mongolian Stomper for a little bit when Stomper came there. Don had a black glove and he loaded it. It had a little compartment where his knuckles were. And when he got a chance, referee was down, he got his referee's attention on something else, he would twist that glove to where a little piece of steel would come across his knuckles and he would knock you out or at least bust your head with it. And no telling how many times he did it to me. And I remember in Knoxville in the summer of 75, probably, we wrestled outside in Chilhowie Park. It was an outside amphitheater. It held probably 10,000. It was a big, big open area with seating built into the side of a mountain. He had knocked me out and busted my head and cost me a bunch of stitches. And I finally took the glove off of him one time. And I got an idea. I said, and rather than give it back to him or whatever, I booked the match the next week. And I said, I'm going to take this glove and put it on the top of the pole. And the first guy that can climb the pole and gets a glove gets to use it. And I found out what was in it once I got it off of him, so I knew what was there. I remember he didn't much want the match. He said, no, 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 you know. And I said, hey, that's what we're going to do. So we actually had one of the, and I remember calling the coal miner's glove match, but that's the glove match I remember with Don Carson. And I remember he got me down, and he actually got to the glove first. But when he got to the top rope, I was able to slam him off the top. And I ended up with a glove, and I busted his noggin with it. Rest is history. 2 weeks later, he was gone. I didn't see him much after that. I did run into him a few times. He was a great talent. Don Carson was a great talent and another fabulous personality. One of the best guys in a dressing room that I ever was with. He put everyone in your dressing rooms in a great frame of mind before they went to the ring. And that was so important. He was important for that ability alone. Great question.
Guy was a deputy sheriff in Cleveland, Tennessee for a while, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, he's been in sheriff departments. I got some stories about it. I'll tell you a real quick one.
Go ahead.
He put his hair up. He had long blonde hair. And I said, Don, I want you to put your hair up in a match against, I can't remember who it was. And he says, oh, Ron, I've had my hair. I'm beautiful. I'm pretty. I don't want to. I said, oh, you ain't going to lose. Oh, no, Conway, I don't want to do it. I finally talked him into it. He loses the match. They shave his head. The next week, I've already purchased the territory from the Fields boys. So Don Carson and I fly from Knoxville to wrestle in Dothan, Alabama. And we're checking in at a Holiday Inn in which they know Don because Don had worked there a long time. So they don't really know me. I'm just starting there. And I check in front of him. And I'm signing up and everything. And I see the girl, she's looking behind me at Don. And I'm ribbing him the whole trip about the flight. He's all perturbed. I got no hair. I'm ugly, Ron. He's just complaining. I'm ugly. Look at me. I've always been pretty and handsome. And now look how ugly I am. And I was making it worse. I was going, boy, you really are, Don. I never dreamed you'd look like that with your head shaved. So I'm checking in. And the girl keeps looking around at him. So he steps up there. And he signs his name, and she looks down at the sheet real quick, and she backs up, kind of sits up right, and she goes, Don Carson. She goes, you have always been ugly, Don, but she says, you are uglier now than I have ever seen you. So that's my Don Carson story.
That's some great stuff. Stud, it's hard to believe. We're reaching the conclusion here of another Studcast. We've just scratch the surface in Memphis. We're in the early 60s, late 50s. There is so much to go, man. We got to get a winner here, though, from our Studcast questions. Is it going to be Frank Burkett of Colonia, Ponepi, Micronesia? Is it going to be Stanley Nix of Crossville, Alabama, or Sean Estep from Knoxville?
All the questions today were magnificent, but I got to go with my boy from Micronesia. I'm going to get myself an atlas out and start taking a look about where the heck Micronesia is. Now, I've done some wrestling in Australia, and I remember stopping my first time going to Australia in New Caledonia. It was a little island somewhere in the mid-Pacific between Honolulu and Sydney. And Micronesia, I'm thinking, is somewhere off of... It's in that little chain of islands that runs west of Hawaii.
You're a smart guy. You're a smart guy.
It's right in there somewhere, isn't it?
Around Fiji. You're a smart guy. Yep. Micronesia is, I'm looking on Mr. Searchy, as we say, it's a subregion of Oceania, thousands of small islands in the Western Pacific Ocean, shared cultural history with two separate island regions, Polynesian to the east and Melanesia to the south. And let's see, Micronesia, where this gentleman is to the west. Yep. It is to the west of, Hawaii, and Guam is in there as well. Wow, that's a feller listening to us from a long, long ways away, my friend. Wrestling fans are everywhere.
They are. Thank God for them, too. I mean, I love it. They are from everywhere. And, you know, how did Frank Burkett, he needs to talk to me and tell me his story. How do you get from wherever Frank Burkett started out to Micronesia? I mean, that's a story in itself. It's just amazing, Tony. We're on a ride here that just, it's freaky. I never know when we sit down here and we get ready to do one of these, where we're going to go. I had no idea we were going to end up in Micronesia. We were in Corsica last week, I think, and now we're in Micronesia. It's an amazing ride here. Just really fun.
The love of wrestling is a global thing. The love of this thing that we share on the Studcast, which is taking the history of the sport of kings, and bringing it back to life where we can enjoy it, we can celebrate it, we can laugh about it, we can cry over it. Stud, a lot of fun today. Close us out here, and it was really a great time with you. Hard to believe that we're in episode 11, and we're coming to the conclusion here of our 11th week together.
Yeah, it's been a great trip. I really love it, Tony. I'm having a lot of fun. It never ceases me every time I look at the numbers, and you know, I've never been a number man. But I'm starting to look at the numbers now, because the numbers of downloads of people listening to the Studcast, the numbers on Facebook and the numbers on Twitter and the numbers on Instagram, it's just boggles my mind. I had no idea that we were going to reach this type of audience and be this popular. I just keep doing these big podcasts. I just keep getting these constant. I don't have time. To go on everybody that would like to have me on. And I would like to do them all, because I want my story to get to everybody that really is a historian for the sport, old school, young school. I don't know what, I don't care whether you're WWE or whether you're 95 years old and you had an old wrestler friend guy or one of your fan of so-and-so way back in the 30s or 40s or whatever. It's just a phenomenal ride for me. I just love saddling up. Every time we get ready to do this, boy, every Sunday night, it's going to roll out on the Studcast. Go to my website, TN Stud. Check it out there. Pick up your Studcast from there. We're going to be iTuning it. We're going to be on all kinds of different platforms. We're probably there already. I never knew it was going to go here. And I'm just proud to be a part of it. And I'm so happy to have you on board. You're great to work with. I look forward to every one we do.
I want to encourage folks, check out my website at tonybasilio.com. You can see how my name is spelled and all that. A link over at the Stud site. Also, Sunday nights, he talked about Sunday night. We're doing a regional show where we talk about the Southeast in college football called Southeastern Sunday Night, 7 to 9 Eastern. It's a call-in show. We call it Mayhem in the PM, and it's really a lot of fun. Stud, really appreciate the time today. Again, if you want to connect with the Stud, you can do so at Facebook, Ron Fuller, Tennessee Stud. The website is tnstud.com. Stud, terrific, man, being with you one more time. Real pleasure this week.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it. Can't wait to saddle up next week.
Yep. Our time is finished here. It's time for me to turn it over to my man, David Summers, who takes us home on another award-winning edition of the Studcast.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains. This Studcast is distributed by Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.